There was no warning in Hangar 15. Sergeant Swinney had returned from his inspection tour and was checking a damaged B-18. Under the plane, some men were changing a bullet-riddled tire. Nearby, the crew chief was explaining how the wheel was assembled to some mechanic who had chosen this particular moment to learn his trade a little better. The bomb plunged through the roof with a deafening roar. The hangar went totally dark, and Swinney thought to himself that this was the end. Then the smoke and dust cleared, and an encouraging shaft of sunlight streamed through the hole. So he was alive after all. But he now had the terrifying feeling that everyone else had completely disintegrated. It was an illusion, however, for after he had groped his way out, alive and unhurt, he saw several dead lying where he had stood. Corporal John Sherwood was working outside Hangar 15 when the high-level attack began. For some reason, he headed for Hangar 13, a poor choice, since it had not yet been damaged. But he found a good corner in the engineering office, lay down, and waited. For the first time that morning, he even had a chance to pray. As the bombs thundered closer, two young lieutenants, both crying like children, ran in and tried to dislodge him. Sherwood told them to go find their own corner. The hangar took several hits, and Sherwood realized he was in the wrong place after all. He ran out, leaving the lieutenants free to take any corner they liked. At the base hospital, Nurse Monica Conter also had to fight for her cover. Lying on the floor with other nurses, doctors, and patients, she had seized the galvanized lid of a brand-new garbage can and was holding it over herself. Someone kept tugging, trying to get it, but she managed to hang on. Once again, good shelter was at a premium. Private Bert Shipley joined four men in a manhole who were firing at the planes with rifles. They knew they wouldn't hit anything, but it made them feel better. Some cooks in the bombed-out mess hall holed up in the freezer. More bombs hit the building, and they were all killed by concussion. Private John Wilson dived under the edge of a one-story frame building. He was glad to find the shelter, but it was even better to be there with his buddy Stan Koenig. He kept thinking if he was going to be killed, he wanted some friend to know about it. Hickam couldn't do much about the high-level attack, but when the dive bombers returned around 9:15, the men fought bitterly with what was left. One airman manned a 30-caliber machine gun in the nose of a damaged B-18 and kept firing until the plane burned out from under him. As fast as men fell at the machine guns on the open parade ground, others rushed out to take their place, and then they too would fall. Old-timers like Sergeant Stanley McLeod, young recruits like Corporal Billy Anderson of Virginia, lay there side by side. A few men somehow survived. Staff Sergeant Chuck Middaugh, a burly 235-pound roughneck always in trouble, grabbed a 30-caliber machine gun in his hands and fired away until he got a plane. On the Ball Diamond, two men set up a machine gun on a tripod between home plate and some trees along the edge of the field. It looked like a pretty safe spot with a good field of fire. Suddenly, a wave of planes roared out of the sky, saturating the field with bombs, scoring a direct hit on the gun, killing both men instantly. They had no way of knowing that the Japanese were sure the Ball Diamond was clever camouflage for Hickam's underground gasoline system. Other bombs did put the system briefly out of action. They hit a water main near its real location, and since it worked by water, it could no longer operate. The damage was serious, but Staff Sergeant Guido Mambretti, the petroleum section's maintenance man, bet Major Robbins a bottle of cognac he could get the thing working again. He did, too, but he still hasn't collected. While Mambretti toiled away, volunteers rushed up and moved several loaded tank trucks out of the storage area. Other volunteers turned up who had no connection at all with Hickam. Major Henry Sachs, an ordnance specialist passing through on his way to the Middle East, dashed to the Hickam cargo pier and took on the job of unloading the SS Haleakala, a munitions ship full of dynamite and hand grenades. A Hawaiian motorcycle club appeared, on the hunch they might be useful. One of the members, a huge, fat native, attached himself to Captain Gordon Blake, who was trying to disperse the B-17s. They made quite a pair bouncing along the runway, the Hawaiian resplendent in Aloha shirt and rhinestone-studded cyclist belt, Blake seated behind, hanging on for dear life. In between motorcycle trips, Blake tried to guide the B-17s still in the air to some place where they could land. One put down on Kahuku Golf Course. Another suddenly turned up at Wheeler. As the pilot climbed out, Colonel William Flood, Wheeler base commander, told him deadpan to get back up and find the Japanese fleet. The pilot looked depressed. "You know, Colonel, we just came over from California." "I know, but son, there's a war on." "Okay," the pilot sighed. "If I can just get a cup of coffee, we're off." Flood couldn't bear to keep the joke going any longer. told the pilot to get some sleep and he'd use him tomorrow. It's hard to say how many planes really did get up from Wheeler. General Howard Davidson, commanding all the fighters, thought about 14. Air Force records indicate no P-40s and only a handful of worthless P-36s. Perhaps the general was counting in Welch and Taylor, who landed 3 different times for ammunition and then took off again. These two were having a busy morning. After reaching Haleiwa, they had rushed straight for their planes. No briefing or checking out. Major Austin, the squadron commander, was off deer hunting, and they didn't bother with Lieutenant Rogers, the acting CO. They just took off. First, they flew down to Barber's Point, where the Japanese were said to be rendezvousing. Nobody there. Just as well, there hadn't been time to belt up enough ammunition. So they dropped by Wheeler to get some more. By 9 o'clock, they were almost ready to take off again when 7 Japanese planes swept in from Hickam for one last strafing run. Welch and Taylor gunned their P-40s and flew straight at them. Both men were up and away before the Japanese could give chase. Instead, the P-40s managed to get into the Japanese flight pattern and shot 2 down. One was the plane that grazed the eucalyptus tree behind Mr. Young's laundry. Then Welch and Taylor headed for Ava, where they had seen some dive bombers at work. It was a picnic. Between them, they got 4 more before Taylor had to land with a wounded arm. Welch stayed on and picked off another. They had plenty of cooperation from the ground. Ava, like the other airfields, was bounding back. Sergeant Emil Peters and Private William Turner manned a machine gun in one of the disabled planes. Sergeant William Turridge manned another. Sergeant Carlo Micheletto was firing 2 until a low-flying strafer cut him down. A piece of shrapnel nicked Lieutenant Colonel Larkin, the base commander, and Captain Leonard Ashwell became another casualty when he sped off on a bicycle to check some sentries. He forgot about a barbed wire fence, careened into it, and arose somewhat the worse for wear. As pharmacist's mate Orrin Smith treated the wounded, he himself was hit in the leg. He patched it up and rejoined his ambulance, which eventually accumulated 52 bullet holes. On the windward side of the island, Bellows tried to fight back too, but a group of Japanese fighters gave the men little chance. Lieutenant George Whitman took up the first P-40 about 9 o'clock, and 6 Zeros got him right away. Next, they pounced on Lieutenant Hans Christensen before he could even get off the ground. Then they caught Lieutenant Sam Bishop just after he took off. He managed to crash land into the ocean and swim to safety. The attack was over before anybody else tried his luck. None of the planes could even fly at nearby Kaneohe. The horizontal bombers took care of everything the strafers missed. Then there was a lull, and the bullhorn bellowed for all hands to fight the hangar fires. Aviation ordnanceman Henry Popko joined a wave of men who surged forward to answer the call. Halfway there, the strafers met them, and the men had to scatter. Seaman Squash Marshall raced for cover with the bullets snapping at his heels. It was another of those classic dashes that seemed to catch everyone's fancy. He actually outran a Zero for 100 yards, according to one man, then zagged to one side as the bullets plowed straight on. The men who watched sent up a huge cheer, just as if someone had hit a home run at a ball game. By 9:30, the dive bombers were back, but now everybody seemed to have some kind of gun. Ensign Hubert Reese and his friend Joe Hill sat in their clump of weeds, popping away with rifles. Others had mounted machine guns on water pipes, on tailwheel assemblies, on anything. Big friendly aviation machinist's mate Ralph Watson cradled a .30-caliber weapon in his arms, kept it going long after he was hit. Suddenly, all guns began to concentrate on one fighter. Everyone had the same idea at once. It seemed like telepathy. Smoke began pouring from the plane. It kept on diving, motor wide open. Ensign Reese wondered if the pilot was crazy. It was hard to believe they were actually shooting one down. But it was true. The pilot never pulled up. As he hit the hillside, there was a cloud of dirt, a burst of fire in the air, and the plane completely disintegrated. It wasn't the gunfire or bombing. It was the door that swung to and fro from the concussion that bothered Lieutenant Commander McCrimmon as he operated on his 3rd patient at the Kaneohe dispensary. The man had a bad stomach wound, and Commander McCrimmon just couldn't concentrate. Finally, he had a sailor hold the door steady so he could finish the operation. He was scrubbing up for the next patient when he suddenly realized what he had done. The door had distracted him so much he had sewed the wrong parts of the stomach together. Before the man came out of ether, McCrimmon had him back on the table, reopened the wound, corrected the error, and sewed him back up.